protests across this country today in response to the president's outrageous comments last night. If you feel safe being at them, you should be at them. You should sign up with groups, whether it's People For or it's Move On or it's the NAACP or Color of Change. We've got to be organized in this moment. And then once we win, and I do believe we will win, we have to make sure that the national popular vote counts. We have to end this crazy sort of gerrymandering of presidential politics where entire demographics are treated like they don't count. Entire states are treated like they don't count. And the American people, frankly, eyes glaze over when they see, you know, and their faith starts to wane when they see the popular vote not matter presidential after presidential after presidential after presidential. So I would just say kind of 1, 2, 3, you know, we did step 1, we turned out to vote. Step 2, make sure every vote is counted. And step 3, make sure that every vote matters.
Ben Jealous, we want to thank you for being with us. President of People for the American Way, Breonna Joy Gray, former press secretary for Bernie Sanders, co-host of the Bad Faith podcast, and John Nichols of The Nation magazine, speaking to us from Wisconsin. That does it for our show. An enormous thank you to our entire team, produced by Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley, Paul Powell. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Guess what? It's fall, so that means it's time for KBOO's annual membership meeting. Join us Saturday, November 7th from 2 to 4 p.m. via Zoom to hear updates about the station, meet candidates running for 4 open board seats, and participate in a lively discussion about KBOO in the year 2020 and beyond. Featuring performing artists Scooter Rogers, Rain Ezra, and host Trista Tyree. To get the link for the meeting, register online by visiting our website kboo.fm/meeting2020. That's kboo.fm/meeting2020.
KBOO is honored to be chosen for Willamette Week's Give Guide. Give Guide handpicked Portland's most impactful nonprofits to help you do good this giving season. You can do good supporting KBOO's work, amplifying the voices and actions that strengthen, empower, and inspire our community. But we know giving goes both ways. Tomorrow, Thursday, November 5th, donating $10 or more will give you a chance to win a $500 shopping spree to Patagonia in Portland. If you're 35 or under, you have another chance of winning when GiveGuide gives away another Patagonia shopping spree to one donor under the age of 36. Donate through our website at kboo.fm/give tomorrow, Thursday, November 5th, and end the year knowing that you did good for your community. That's tomorrow, Thursday, November 5th.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, local and statewide election results are in, and Mayor Ted Wheeler has been reelected. We'll be giving you all sorts of updates on local and statewide races. Biden takes Wisconsin, but the long-awaited presidential election is still too close to call, and the city of Portland will remain under state law enforcement command until Friday evening. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 4th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. Portland kept its mayor and acquired a new city commissioner while most ballot measures passed locally and statewide. Mayor Ted Wheeler won a second term while Mingus Mapps defeated incumbent city commissioner Chloe U. Daly. Oregon's 4 incumbent Congress members, Suzanne Bonamici, Earl Blumenauer, Kurt Schrader, and Peter DeFazio, were all reelected, while Cliff Betts won the open 2nd District seat. In statewide races, Senator Jeff Merkley, Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum, and State Treasurer Tobias Reed were all reelected, with Shamia Fagan winning the open Secretary of State position. State Democrats maintained their supermajorities in the State House and Senate. All 4 state ballot measures passed. setting new campaign finance limits, increasing and expanding the tobacco tax, decriminalizing small amounts of illegal drugs, and legalizing medical use of psilocybin. A new tax to pay for tuition-free preschool in Multnomah County passed, as did the bond measure for the county libraries. Portland voters approved a police oversight board, a parks measure, and a public school bond, but defeated a measure to loosen restrictions on water fund spending. The proposed Metro Transit tax was defeated, while Jarrett Rosenthal and Mary Nolan won seats on the Metro Council. The passage of Measure 110, decriminalizing the possession of small amounts of illicit drugs, is giving Oregon international attention as the first state in the country to do so. Now that the measure has passed, with nearly 59% of the vote, racial disparities in drug arrests are expected to drop by 94%, according to the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. The measure also moves some of the tax revenue from legal marijuana sales into drug rehabilitation programs. Yesterday, Oregon also became the first state to legalize the medical use of psilocybin with the passage of Measure 109. But Oregon wasn't alone in relaxing drug laws, with four more states, New Jersey, Arizona, Montana, and South Dakota, legalizing recreational marijuana, and Mississippi legalizing medical use of marijuana. One in three Americans now live in states where marijuana use is legal. The Oregon Health Authority reported 597 new cases of COVID-19 on Wednesday, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 47,057. Yesterday marks the second highest amount of cases reported in one day. The highest amount of cases was 600 reported on October 30th. Oregon has reported at least 500 new daily cases for 6 days in a row. Oregon health officials reported 4 new deaths, bringing the state's death toll up to 705 people. Multnomah County reported the largest number of new infections with 172, followed by Marion County with 83 cases. Nationally, more than 9.5 million people in the U.S. have been infected with the novel coronavirus. At least 233,000 people have died. Case numbers have reached alarming new records in recent days as outbreaks continue to grow across the United States. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 47.8 million people in nearly every country. At least 1.2 million people have died of the illness across the world. Coalitions in Oregon have events planned across the state to ensure that every vote is counted. Eric Tegedoff with the Public News Service has more on the story.
A wide-ranging coalition is holding rallies today in several Oregon cities and nationwide to underscore the need to count every vote. The groups Indivisible and Stand Up America have said they were prompted to organize the project Protect the Results before the election because of President Donald Trump's past statements hinting he might not concede if he loses. Terry O'Neill is a volunteer with the Defend Democracy Coalition, which is hosting an event in Portland.
We are concerned that around the country, people's votes might not be counted. And so we are part of a nationwide mobilization.
The Defend Democracy Coalition's Count Every Vote PDX event starts at 3 p.m. at Revolution Hall. At least 8 other rallies are scheduled across Oregon, including in Bend, Medford, and Pendleton, according to the Protect the Results website. The national coalition includes labor unions, racial justice, and environmental groups. O'Neill notes there have been threats of violence across the country, including in Oregon, which is part of the reason why organizers are emphasizing that this movement is peaceful.
We know that nonviolent mobilizations are the ones that win. Those are the mobilizations that prevail. And so we are dedicated to nonviolence.
O'Neill also sees this as a continuation of the movement for Black Lives, saying that electoral justice is racial justice.
One of the reasons that our country is struggling with so much systemic racism is precisely because communities of color have been blocked from voting for so long.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The city of Portland will remain under state and county law enforcement until Friday at 5 p.m., In a Wednesday morning statement, Governor Kate Brown acknowledged the presidential election's lack of clarity, saying it may be several days until we know the official outcome. She also said that state and county law enforcement will continue to lead local law enforcement in response to any protests in the city. Brown stated, quote, "All Oregonians have the right to free expression and peaceful assembly, but political violence, intimidation, and property destruction will not be tolerated. We are all in this together, so let's work together to keep our fellow Oregonians safe." The order, which was initially set to expire on Wednesday at 5 p.m., was extended and will now expire at 5 p.m. on Friday. A financial webinar being held on Friday is designed to prepare Oregonians for financial resilience in the face of disasters. Eric Tegedoff has more on that story.
An online conference is preparing Oregonians for financial resilience in the face of disasters. AARP and the Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services are co-hosting the webinar on Friday to provide tips and tools to help people get back on their feet after this year's wildfires, as well as to prepare for any future catastrophes. DCBS Director Andrew Stolfi says folks should be on the lookout for fraud after calamities like the fires.
There's unfortunately people who are trying to prey on the vulnerable, and it's important for people to be aware of potential frauds, whether it's by a contractor or someone trying to sell some services or some help to people in a time of need.
Stolfi notes the state has free resources available for anyone affected by the wildfires. The webinar starts at 11:30 a.m. this Friday. Stolfi says it's also important for people to plan for the possibility of future emergencies.
It's important to do that, from making a home inventory to working with your insurance agent and company every year when your policy renews, to make sure that you have the right coverages in place. And we have resources on our website for people to check about how to do each of those steps.
Other speakers for the event include Oregon Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum, President and CEO of the Oregon Bankers Association Linda Navarro, and AARP Oregon State Director Ruby Houghton Pitts. Folks can sign up on AARP Oregon's website for the hour-long webinar. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Associated Press declared Joe Biden the winner of Wisconsin this afternoon, quickly followed by multiple other news outlets. The presidential race in Wisconsin is considered key to an Electoral College win. With the addition of Wisconsin's 10 Electoral College votes, Biden leads the Associated Press tally with 248 electoral votes to President Donald Trump's 214 at the time of recording. Trump won Wisconsin in an upset in 2016, defeating Hillary Clinton by a mere 30,000 votes. This year's race is even tighter, with Biden ahead by just over 20,000 votes. President Trump is already calling for a recount of votes in Wisconsin. Past recounts in the state rarely produce a difference of more than a couple hundred votes, according to the New York Times. At the time of this recording, the Associated Press has not called the highly contested battleground states of Michigan and Pennsylvania for either candidate, though CNN and the New York Times have declared Biden the winner in Michigan. President Trump announced this morning he is suing Michigan and Pennsylvania to temporarily halt the counting of additional votes until ballots can be reviewed and tallying can be observed. Trump's campaign is also looking into a Pennsylvania Supreme Court case seeking to determine whether mail-in ballots received 3 days after the election can be counted. Last week, the state Supreme Court rejected a Republican-led effort to cut the voting deadline. Pennsylvania has over 3.1 million mail-in ballots, which the state legally accepts as long as they are postmarked by Election Day. The state was unable to begin counting these ballots until Election Day, slowing the results down even further. Early this morning, Trump declared, quote, "We'll be going to the U.S. Supreme Court. We want all voting to stop." The Associated Press points out voting has already stopped when polls closed on election night. Voting isn't continuing past Election Day, but the counting of votes is. Experts had warned Americans they wouldn't know results until well after Election Day due to the unprecedented number of mail-in ballots this year. Biden addressed press and supporters from Delaware this afternoon, responding to the president's attempts to undermine the integrity of the election. He said, quote, "Now every vote must be counted. No one's going to take our democracy away from us. Not now, not ever. America has come too far." The long-awaited 2020 election is still too close to call, as critical states are still counting their ballots. Lily Bolke reports on the situation with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
It's not my place or Donald Trump's place to declare who's won this election. That's the decision of the American people.
Too close to call the presidency yesterday, with crucial battleground states Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin still counting mail-in ballots. Former Vice President Joe Biden cautioned supporters to, quote, keep the faith. The nation also waited in 2000 and 2004. In contrast, President Donald Trump, without the final tallies, called the election, quote, a big win, unquote, and falsely accused Democrats of trying to, quote, steal it.
A very sad group of people is trying to disenfranchise that group of people, and we won't stand for it.
A legion of lawyers is ready to protect the vote. Earlier, Michigan Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson set the record straight.
No matter how long it takes, no matter what candidates say, we're going to work methodically and meticulously to count every single valid ballot, and that, and only that, will determine who wins.
Candidates can tie with electoral votes, then the new House of Representatives decides in January. Each state delegation gets one vote. Currently, Republicans control 26 states out of 50. In some of the most watched Senate races, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell held on to his seat, as did South Carolina's Lindsey Graham. Democrats lost one seat. Republican Tommy Tuberville beat incumbent Doug Jones in Alabama and gained two. Democrats Mark Kelly in Arizona and John Hickenlooper in Colorado. Hickenlooper unseated Cory Gardner.
I want to say to everyone that voted for him, I'll be your senator as well.
In Delaware, Sarah McBride, a Democratic activist, became the first openly transgender person in any state Senate. And Richie Torres, the Democrat who won New York's 15th district, is the first openly gay Black man elected to Congress. Overall, voting seemed to go smoothly with the usual hiccups. Some polling sites opened late or had trouble with their electronic poll books, and isolated reports of disinformation and voter intimidation, including misleading robocalls to voters in a number of states.
Just to scare people and to dissuade people from voting, and, you know, potential mis- and disinformation as well.
Damon Hewitt with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights says Election Protection Coalition members across the country worked to get the correct information to voters. Late in the day, the Justice Department told a federal judge that U.S. Postal Service would not obey the court's order to sweep mail processing facilities in 15 states, some battleground states, for any outstanding ballots to make sure they would be delivered before polls closed on Election Day. The court order was in response to a USPS report that more than 300,000 ballots could not be traced. Sylvia Albert is with Common Cause.
We are glad to see Judge Sullivan pushing U.S. Postal Service to ensure that all efforts are made to get voters' ballots in and able to be counted.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the upcoming Portland Book Festival. After that, it's news from the BOO from co-station manager Jenna Yokoyama. At 7, stick around for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, we can expect showers with a low of 57 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy with a high of 60. Today in history, on this day in 2008, Barack Obama was elected President of the United States. He, along with running mate Joe Biden, ran against John McCain and Sarah Palin, winning 365 electoral votes. The quote of the day is from author and activist Alice Walker, who said, quote, "The most common way people give up their power is by thinking they don't have any." KBOO News poet Dan Raphael isn't holding his breath.
When the going gets tough and the oppressed get active, the powerful use their power. Locally, no surprise. Ted stays, Chloe goes, most of the ballot measures pass, Oregon's five Democratic Congress folks all get reelected. But nationally, control of the Senate and White House still unclear, though Donnie claimed victory and said people should stop voting, which they had for hours. While Warren Zevon in the background sings send lawyers, guns, and money, Donnie sends his minions to the Supreme Court in a couple states. Even when the results are in, he probably won't agree. While COVID rages on, the economy keeps worsening, winter's coming for the vulnerable, and the Senate smirks instead of helping. Time to start a load of laundry and take a walk before the rains return. We each have so much more control over our lives than all of politicians. Let every day be a landslide for compassion and joy. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
All of the current Native American members of Congress were reelected yesterday, and three Indigenous women will now serve in the Kansas State Legislature. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As Native voters keep an eye on the U.S. presidential race, all current Native American members of Congress won re-election Tuesday. Democrats Deb Haaland from New Mexico and Sharice Davids from Kansas, and Republicans from Oklahoma Tom Cole and Mark Wayne Mullen. Mullen thanked his family and supporters at a watch party, which was streamed online.
It's been a challenging year for us all. It's been a challenging year for us as a family. It's been a challenging year for us as a country. It's been a challenging year for us as a state.
David spoke at a virtual Kansas Democratic Party event.
Our victory would not have been possible without the hard work of so many of you. Every phone call that you made, text that you sent, or conversation that you had has made this victory possible.
Joining the Native delegation is Yvette Harrell, Republican who won a tight congressional race in New Mexico, while other Native candidates running for Congress in Idaho, Wisconsin, and Wyoming lost their bids. Three Native women in Kansas won seats in the state legislature. Rhonda Lavaldo has more.
Winning her sixth term was Ponkawee Victors, Tahana Otham, Ponca Nation, for Kansas District 103 last night. Also two newcomers, Christina Haswood, Dene, for Kansas District 10, and Stephanie Byers, Chickasaw, for Kansas District 86, who is also the first transgender woman in the state's legislature. Haswood was unopposed and talked about her feelings on being the youngest sitting legislature on election day.
I am excited, extremely honored, at the same time nervous, just for this new role. And I feel ready. I feel ready to step up for my community. And this election night is extremely one of the, you know, important elections of our lifetime. And I think everyone today is kind of really reflecting on that. But for my election, running unopposed, I just feel completely grateful and honored that the voters voted me in, and I am ready to represent them in Topeka.
With the current pandemic, Haswood talked about her main priority she wanted to address.
I know here in Douglas County, we've seen a rise and fall of COVID cases. And I believe in the rural areas, we saw some new data that came out saying that their COVID cases are continue to rise. I'm trying to find out and work with other public health and healthcare professionals on what would be the best measure for getting this under control and making Kansas better than before, getting our economy back together, making sure that we don't make too much of a quick decision on schools with COVID cases, making sure that the teachers. So I think COVID-19 and making sure that we have Medicaid expanded as well.
This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
In Minnesota, a Native candidate seeking Bemidji City Council's at-large seat will advance to a runoff election in early 2021, the Bemidji Pioneer reports. Daniel Jourdain is running on a platform to improve public safety, housing, economic development, and infrastructure. Jourdain spoke about running for office and getting out the vote on Native Roots Radio Tuesday night.
I think the support, everybody's been chiming in here and there and saying good luck, and, you know, I already voted for you, so just hearing those types of things in the community, that's what makes it feel a lot more relaxing. And just knowing that, you know, they got a good representative that would speak up for them in the city. Rock the Vote is doing a great part here with all the reservations, with Red Lake, White Earth, and Leech Lake. Oh my God, just all their canvassing that they're doing, the posts that you see, everything you see out there, just like the Native Vote is really turning out this year.
Four people were vying for the Bemidji city seat, but no one received more than 50% of the vote to win. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Fair election advocates are preparing to protect the results of the election in the form of rallies and protests across the nation. Andrea Sears has more with the Public News Service.
Election protection advocates around the country are planning rallies and protests if they see any attempt to interfere with a full count of ballots cast in the election. They're calling it Protect the Results, a grassroots demand that the will of the voters, as reflected in the election outcome, be respected. Organizers say they're ready to hold nonviolent rallies and protests in more than 500 communities nationwide. Justin Hendricks, an organizer in New York City, says the preparations are a response to President Donald Trump suggesting that he might not commit to a peaceful transfer of power if Joe Biden is the winner.
We see direct action as a necessary tactic to be taken if, in fact, the president chooses not to accept the results of the 2020 election.
Trump has claimed that mail-in ballots may be fraudulent and should not be counted past Election Day. Information about these gatherings is online at protecttheresults.com. Hendricks notes the goal is to be prepared to act in the event that the administration tries to undermine the election results.
If Donald Trump takes actions to interfere in the vote count, if he declares an early victory and calls on Joe Biden to concede before the votes have all been taken into consideration, if he ultimately refuses to concede, all of these are the types of scenarios that we're planning for.
Before the election, Republicans filed lawsuits over ballot drop boxes, drive-through voting, and extended time to count votes, and President Trump has said more lawsuits will be filed. The huge volume of mail-in ballots cast this year means in some areas, including critical battleground states, counting those votes could take days and there will undoubtedly be court challenges. So Hendricks says the preparations will remain in place well after Election Day.
We're going to remain ready throughout the transition period. And if, in fact, a week or 2 weeks from now, Donald Trump or the Republican Party cross one of these lines, then we'll be ready.
Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
An Antarctic iceberg stretching 93 miles long and 30 miles wide is heading for the island of South Georgia in the southern Atlantic Ocean, which is roughly the same size as the iceberg itself. Iceberg A68A broke off the Larsen C ice shelf of Antarctica in July 2017. It could end up disrupting the British territory's economy and wildlife. The thin profile of the iceberg, about 650 feet thick, may make it more likely to float closer to South Georgia before getting stuck on the ocean floor. Such a massive barrier could impact penguins and seals that breed on South Georgia, making it necessary for them to travel further to find food. A car outfitted with special sensors is measuring air pollution block by block in Brooklyn. The data will show residents how much pollution they're exposed to at home, school, or work. With more on the story, here's Dr. Anthony Lizowitz with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. From air pollution caused by cars and trucks to methane leaks,
many of the same emissions that cause climate change also harm public health.
Crystal Upperman is with ACLIMA, a California-based company that measures ground-level air pollution. She says the results vary dramatically, even on a local level. For example, ACLIMA mapped air quality on city streets in Oakland, California. It found
air pollution levels can persistently vary from one end of the block to another, as much as by 800%.
Now the company is measuring and mapping emissions on the other side of the country. It's using a low-emission vehicle that's outfitted with sensing technology.
And it'll be measuring air pollutant and greenhouse gas levels block by block in Brooklyn.
It will collect data day and night for 3 months. The results will allow residents to see how much pollution they're exposed to at home, school, or work, and it can help identify the specific sources.
Communities can use the information to put forward very stringent, rigorous steps to reduce air pollution emissions and also help protect the health of their populations
while reducing global warming. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 4th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Samantha Law, Dan Raphael, and Ken Jones. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonio Gonzalez, Anthony Lizowitz, Mike Moen, Andrea Sears, and Eric Tegadoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Juneteenth Radio, bringing you the latest stories happening in African American and Black society. At 9, it's Fight the Empire, connecting world history with current events. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news journalism with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Between the Covers, featuring interviews with local and nationally known authors. And stick around at 11:30, tune in for Black Book Talk for an interview with award-winning author James McBride. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth, exploring the Portland Book Festival.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
The Portland Book Festival is our city's biggest literary event and one of the most popular on the entire West Coast. This year, as with just about every event other than super spreader campaign rallies, the festival is going virtual. Instead of one big day, it will take place over several weeks entirely online, from November 5th through the 21st, and feature more than 100 authors, and here's just a very short list: Margaret Atwood, Jess Walter, Isabel Wilkerson, Karen Russell, Lydia Yuknovich, Claudia Rankin, Joe Sacco, Charles Yu, Jonathan Lethem, Julia Alvarez, Ruman Alam, Suvankam Tamavangsa, T. Kira Madden, Joanna Rose, Liz Crane, Megha Majumdar, and Vanessa Veselka. And again, that's just a few. To give us a preview, we're fortunate to have Amanda Bullock with us. She's the festival director, and she's been our guest the past few years before every Portland Book Festival. And I'm very happy we can continue that tradition. Amanda, welcome back, even if it's remotely.
Thank you, Ken. It's so good to see you, even on a screen. So
same here. Now, of course, the big question is, Amanda, you and the Portland Book Festival organizers at Literary Arts had a real big decision to make this year during the pandemic. Of course, it's a big health risk to conduct the events in person as usual at the Portland Art Museum and neighboring venues. Did you consider canceling the 2020 festival, or were you all kind of in agreement right away about taking it online?
We never considered canceling, never seriously. You know, you consider all your options, but it was always, to me and to the other leadership at Literary Arts, we knew it was really important to hold this space, like to create this space, both for the authors and for the audience, to have the kind of conversations that happen at the book festival. So from even before we knew for sure we were going to have to move online, the planning was always like, what do we do instead? How do we adapt? How do we innovate? How do we make sure that we're still providing this space to everybody?
How'd you decide to do it over, instead of one jam-packed day, over the course of a little over 2 weeks, with several events per day and a total of over 50 events for the whole festival?
Yeah, I wanted to keep it the same size. So we're usually about 50 events in the one day and over 100 authors. And it was important to me to remain about that size. And it didn't seem, with all of our lives being on Zoom and video and live stream and that, it didn't seem like saying 8 hours of this in a row would be that appealing to everybody. Of course, everybody's in a different circumstance. And so in order to keep the number of authors and the number of events, we stretched it out. And so no events are happening simultaneously. There's only one thing happening at a time, which is a really big shift from the in-person festival. Part of the festivalness of it, I think, is that there's a lot of different things happening at once. So we do hear from the audience a lot that they wish they could go to everything. And this year, it's true. You can literally go to everything. You can go to every single festival event, because not only are they live at different times, but most of them will be available to watch afterwards on replay as well. So you can kind of move at your own pace, although I do encourage people to attend the live events if they get a chance to, because you'll be able to ask questions and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you wrote this great article posted on the Literary Arts site. It's called How to Build Your Best Portland Book Festival 2020. And of course, we miss the camaraderie, you know, of being with other readers and actually seeing our favorite authors in person. But in addition to attending several events and not having to pick and choose, you know, because there's three or four going on at the same time that you all want to see, there are several advantages of the virtual format. That's one. Can you give us a few more? I think one you just mentioned was you can actually watch some of these events after they occur on demand on the website.
Yes, we built a custom streaming site, so everything's going to be at pdxbookfest.org. And that'll be where the live stream lives every day. You don't need a special link for each event. You just go right there. It's like having a radio station where you just tune in and kind of see what's going on. And then in addition to the live events, most or all of the events will be available within 2 days in a video library on that site. So you'll be able to watch things on demand kind of at your own pace. And then when you do attend live, you know, everybody's in the front row. Like, we've heard that from some of the live events that we've done so far. People really enjoy, it is more intimate in some ways because you're really just like face to face with the author. And, you know, a lot of times you're being invited into the author's home. And there are some cool things about the format for sure. I really like attending things live too because of the chat, which we'll also have, which is where attendees can talk to each other. So even though you do miss seeing people in person, it can be really fun to be like, oh my God, Ken's here. Like, hi, Ken. Like, and you can like kind of see your friends, even your friends from across the country. Like, I've seen folks from the East Coast attending the same events as me. And it's actually been a really nice like community building moment, especially now.
And of course, if you were there in person, you wouldn't yell out "Hi, Ken" across the room during the event. So
no, so, just wave subtly.
Yeah, you also mentioned in the article, Amanda, that people can be more adventurous because they don't really have to pick four or five events they're going to see that day. Theoretically, you can see them all if you like, and especially with the archived video. So that's a big plus.
I think so too. And there's also like, if you just drop in on something, you don't have to like, if you're not into it, you don't have to like sneak out. You can just close the browser or whatever. So there's really, really low kind of risk in trying something new and maybe checking something out that you might not have been able to see in person.
And of course, since it's Portland, we often don't get the best weather the day of the Portland Book Festival when it's in person. So you're not necessarily standing in a long line in the rain or the cold. And of course, there's some events you could stand in a long line and still not get in because it's just fully occupied. So there's a lot of pluses to the virtual format. Now, for listeners to attend events, all they need is a computer, tablet, smartphone, and they need to register in advance.
Yeah, we recommend, I mean, you could register right before, but we recommend registering in advance just so you're all set. But you just need to register one time for the site. We do have on the Literary Arts site for each event, you can RSVP and you'll get really convenient email reminders. And there's little add to calendar buttons on there, which I know I find really useful, especially right now. And I'm even more tied to my iCal than before. There's three events that you'll need to do a little more planning ahead for. We do have Book as Ticket, so a book purchase is required for Jess Walter, which is on the 5th, Margaret Atwood on the 17th, and Isabel Wilkerson on the 19th. And for logistical reasons, those ticket sales do close 2 days in advance. So if you want to go to any of those events or all of them, which I encourage you to, I'm really excited about all of them, you do want to go ahead and make that book purchase so that you're all set up.
So that's just a matter of purchasing their latest book, like Margaret Atwood's is a book of poems, Dearly.
Yeah, and she's in conversation with Karen Russell, who I know was just on the
show. Oh man, I love Karen. Well. Yeah, she's a Portland resident now.
Yeah, she is a treasure of a human for sure. So I'm really excited about that conversation. And just make sure you buy the book through the link on the Literary Arts website that's associated with the event. And that is your ticket. That's all. It's all in one. So And if you can't make the time of those events, the book purchase does give you access to the replay of those. So you'll be able to watch it if you...
That's a killer pairing, Margaret Atwood and Karen Russell, for a number of reasons. They, of course, Margaret's latest book is poetry, Dearly, but they both wrote speculative fiction that seems more prescient than ever right now. Margaret's Handmaid's Tale, of course, with what's going on in the Supreme Court and possibly overturning Roe versus Wade. And then Karen's latest book is Sleep Donation, which is a reprint from a 2014 edition, was ebook only, which kind of talks about a sleep pandemic, not quite COVID-19, but again, very relevant. I was wondering how you made these pairings. They're not, these ticketed events aren't the only ones. A lot of other events are also pairings between two authors.
Yeah, the festival is in person and online is really focused on conversations between authors. And sometimes that's two authors directly in conversation with each other. Sometimes there's a moderator to help guide the conversation. It kind of ranges. And yeah, Margaret, I asked Karen to interview Margaret because I know that Karen, they do have that in common with their fiction, but Karen's also a really good reader of poetry and a really thoughtful reader. And I knew that she would be able to kind of bring together like the many different aspects of Margaret's work and bring a really, just really thoughtful and like joyful lens to it. So I'm really excited about that. And she's a local, so we like to feature, you know, our local Portland and Oregon Pacific Northwest writers.
And we have this incredible literary community here with some of the best writers in the world living in Portland.
Yeah, we're so grateful for it. Yeah.
Now, in addition to the author events, where they're usually paired in conversation with somebody, there traditionally you have the pop-up events at the Portland Art Museum, and that's when an author does a reading in front of an appropriate work of art. Will you be doing those virtually this year?
We will, actually. I'm really excited about it. Liz Olofsson, who works with me on the festival, helped manage this with the museum, and the museum's been really supportive and excited about it. So we actually already filmed them, and so we invited, I think it's somewhere between 15 and 20. We focused on local writers this year because they could get to the museum. We filmed the author's reading in the museum, and then those videos will be available on demand in the video library at pdxbookfest.org, where everything's live streaming. And then they'll also be showing up on our Literary Arts Instagram throughout the festival to sort of mimic that. Like, one of my favorite things about the pop-ups is that you might just be wandering around the museum during the festival and like run into them. And so to sort of provide that serendipity, we'll also be, you know, deploying them on social media so you could get surprised by Liz talking about dumplings in the art museum, which is really wonderful. Yeah.
There's always an incredible diversity at the book festival among the authors, gender, race, ethnicity, the types of books they write. And also you have pretty much something for every age group, including children, teenagers. Can you talk about the events this year at the book festival for the different age groups? I mean, there's picture books, young adult, of course, adult fiction, nonfiction, cookbooks like Liz's.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite things about festivals is the density and the diversity that they provide. And we really do try to have something for everyone and like a door that every type of reader can walk through. And I'm really proud of that. And in terms of events for different age groups, we do have lots of events for adults, of course, in nonfiction, fiction, and poetry, and all those subgenres. So Saturday, November 7th and Saturday, November 14th are actually dedicated to kids and teen programming. And so we have some great story times that will be played during those days, as well as programming for middle grade readers featuring some really amazing authors. And we have some YA programming those days as well. And then there'll also be a kind of smattering of middle grade and YA programming during the week. And then for picture books, because that, you know, picture book audience is typically quite young, those story times and some really, really great art activities, and they're all hosted by Emily Arrow, who, if you've been to the festival before, you will have seen hosting the picture book stage. Those videos will be available on demand starting on Saturday, November 7th. And so families can watch those kind of at their leisure. You can watch them all at once. You can watch them over and over. You can watch one each day. And so I'm really excited for those to be a resource and just some entertainment for kids and adults alike. I actually really like watching them because they're really joyful and they're really fun. And I think we could all use a little bit of that right
now. I'll be doing that for the first time this year because, again, the schedule allows that. There's many events over more than 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Now, where can listeners find out more about the book festival, the list of authors, the schedule of events, how to register?
Yeah, it's literary-arts.org/PBF for Portland Book Festival. And we actually just posted right before we started talking a really convenient one-page version of the schedule. So you can just print it out, highlight everything you want to go to, make sure you can keep track of everything. And you can RSVP for events on that site as well so that you get reminders and you can add them to your calendar. Literary Arts also has a radio show and podcast called The Archive Project. And you'll catch a bunch of festival events on there as well.
Well, Amanda, again, thanks for joining us today and for talking to us about the Portland Book Festival. I'm just ecstatic. we're going to be having it. And online has several advantages, along with the disadvantages, but maybe next year, 2021, we'll all be together again.
Thank you so much. It's always so fun to talk to you. And hopefully I'll be able to, you know, say hi in the chat and see you.
Yes, yell across the room.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks, Amanda.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking with Amanda Bullock, director of the Portland Book Festival, which takes place entirely online this year from Thursday, November 5th through Saturday, November 21st. You can find out more online at pdxbookfest.org. That's also where you can register for events, tune into the live stream throughout the festival, and access the video library of recordings. This is Ken Jones for KBOO's News in Depth.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.